Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy, New York, and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting live from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr., with a bad cold, but nevertheless, I'm here in the seat.
And I'm Simone. Tonight, current events in climate, technology, and film.
Then this week's episode on the Triple E's education, empowerment, entrepreneurship.
And later on, hear more about how Food and Water Action are fighting to stop the Williams Pipeline.
After that, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks to Michael Barrett about the history of the 1863 Troy Draft Riot.
Finally, hear from Rensselaer County's District Attorney Mary Pat Donnelly on bail reform. But first, some headlines.
Okay. The Times Union reports that Governor Andrew Cuomo was apparently inappropriately briefed on details of a closed-door vote by the State Joint Commission on Public Ethics last January after the panel voted on whether to investigate Joseph Perico, a former top aide to the governor, for his use of state resources while serving as Cuomo's campaign manager. The information about Perico's improper campaign work emerged during his federal criminal trial in 2018 when he was convicted on corruption and bribery charges. The state inspector general's office apparently determined that they were unable to substantiate the complaint. Though they have not released a public report, it was not the first time that Cuomo was accused of improperly interfering with the work of a state investigative committee. The member of JCOPE, who apparently made the complaint, resigned after the IG failed to take action.
Good government advocates are harshly criticizing the commission charged with rewriting New York's campaign finance system for failing to rein in the role of big money in elections. The commission is recommending only minor reductions in the sky-high contribution limits to state legislative candidates while providing public matching funds for large contributions. A motion to limit individual contributions to the governor to $15,000 was defeated. Groups such as Reinvent Albany described the proposals as an entrenched incumbent protection program. The type of system being developed by the commission was unprecedented compared to other publicly funded election models across the country.
New testimony at the congressional hearings on President Trump's impeachment included reports of a conversation Trump directly had with his European Union ambassador, Gordon Sutherland, asking him about the Ukraine's investigation into former Vice President Biden's. Trump's defenders had previously argued that various administration officials had acted based on what they thought Trump wanted rather than Trump directly pushing them on the issue.
National Science Foundation has awarded Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, a grant totaling $22,189 and Union College $50,956 to fund interdisciplinary research seeking to measure rock and mineral defects to better understand Earth's geological history. This project will also contribute to the education and research training of several undergraduate students and provide opportunities for interdisciplinary work between the earth sciences.
Okay, for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Okay, and segment number one. On the New York State climate change front, we first talked with Alex Bacalchamp of Food and Water Action about the ongoing fight over the Williams pipeline, including governor's threat to yank National Grid's license to operate downstate and the Green New York Deal effort in New York. We then hear from Bob Cohen of Citizen Actions about New York's Renew's call for $1 billion in upcoming state budget for climate initiatives with a justice focus, along with their push for the polluter penalty, by Mark Dunlea for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
So we're talking with Alex Beecham of the Food and Water Watch Action. He's one of the groups that are really leading the fight against the Williams pipeline, which has been the center, of course, of some controversy with the Cuomo administration. Where is this situation with the Williams pipeline at the present moment?
Yes, in some ways it's the same as it's been, right? Governor Cuomo denied a key permit for the Williams pipeline in May, which we hope is effectively killing the project. The company immediately reapplied, and so technically that's where it's at. You know, in the meantime, there's been a moratorium on new gas hookups that National Grid declared in Brooklyn, Queens, and parts of Long Island. And interestingly, Governor Cuomo has gone very, very hard at National Grid this week, releasing a letter saying essentially that you've got to shape up or we're going to revoke your license. So I think that is a very, very good sign that the Williams pipeline will never be built. In the letter, Governor Cuomo goes to great length to show how ridiculous it was to depend and to have all of their planning dependent on one speculative private pipeline, as he puts it in the letter. So that, I think, is very, very good news for the Williams pipeline fight. And now the struggle, I think, for all of us is to make sure that the solution is heat pumps, energy efficiency, and not just moving around fracked gas some other way, right, with trucks or barges or whatever else.
That, unfortunately, was one of the things that the governor mentioned in his letter, was even putting, fracked gas on barges and raising the possibility again of liquefied natural gas. That appears to be a mistake on his part.
It does. You know, he mentions positive stuff in there too, right? So I think it's kind of in the balance, right? What we do to change the way we heat our homes and our businesses on Long Island and down here in the city, I think, is an open question. And he named a bunch of positive stuff too. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to push the positives and to make sure we don't just keep relying on fracked gas. And there's a moment here, right, to really turn the page and take the state in another direction, but we're going to have to force the governor to do it.
Now, of course, last session, the legislature and the governor agreed to do a climate deal. It did set, somewhat ambitious goals on moving to renewable electricity, 70% by 2030, but it did not say that the state was going to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure. Is that an issue, do you think, advocates are going to try to raise, in the 2020 legislative session?
I think it is, yeah. There's a number of bills that would do exactly that, to mandate the state not build new fossil fuel projects. We'll obviously support those at Food and Water Action. I think a bunch of others will. At the same time, though, the governor has real proposals in front of him, right? So the Dan Scammer power plant in Newburgh, the Williams pipeline we just talked about. And so in a lot of ways, it's up to the governor, right? He can either approve these projects or he can deny them. We're obviously going to push him to deny them.
And I see that recently, Food and Water Action has been out talking about the concept of public power, taking public ownership of some of the utility systems. What caused Food and Water Action to sort of move in that direction?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing the limits of private ownership of our utilities, right? And as Food and Water Action, we've fought for years to keep our water utilities public, in public hands. They largely are in New York, with some minor exceptions. The same is true of power, though, right? There's no reason this should be led by a private company. And when you have that profit motive in there, it makes it a lot harder to make the necessary transition to renewables, and especially at the speed at which we need to do it. So we should take it back.
I guess the last question, Food and Water Action is part of this new Green New Deal coalition in New York State, talking about things like stopping fossil fuels, moving faster on renewable energy, public power, but also taxing the rich to help pay for this transition. Taxing the rich doesn't seem to sit too well with the Democrats yet in the state legislature. How do you hope to overcome some of this resistance?
Yeah, I mean, I think a tax of any kind seems pretty unwelcome to the Democrats in the legislature, so that's certainly true. I mean, look, to us, we're going to have to fund this stuff, right? We passed a huge climate bill last year. It has no funding in it at all, and so we ought to fund it progressively. We ought to have the richest New Yorkers pay for it. And so that's what we're calling for. Others are calling for a carbon tax or some other proposal. We think the right way to do this is to tax the rich. And look, the politics of this session are going to be pretty hard, but if you build a movement big enough, I think it's possible you get it. And if you don't get it, I think we're probably dealing with a better legislature post-2020 election. So you lay the groundwork for that.
And people want to find out more about Food and Water Watch Action, I guess you got a website?
We do, foodandwateraction.org.
Thank you, Alex Beecham. Next, we catch up with Bob Cohen, who's with Citizen Action, which is one of the core groups of New York Renews. New York Renews is one of the groups that helped pass the Community Leadership and Climate Protection Act last session. Bob, what's New York Renews climate agenda for the coming year?
Well, clearly, there's a huge amount that needs to be done over the next couple of years to just prepare for implementing the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. The state agencies have to appoint people to this task force called the Climate Action Council. They have to staff up, et cetera. But New York Renews believes that we have to act really quickly. Obviously, we have a climate crisis, and we have to act very quickly. So the first thing that we are starting with is a $1 billion proposal for renewables. We believe that New York State has to start somewhere and begin the transition to renewables that is contemplated in the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act.
Now, I understand part of the purpose of the $1 billion is also to help begin to fund some of the environmental justice needs that the new bill is supposed to require?
Yeah, so clearly the bill has a provision that that a certain percentage, it turns out 35 or 40% of the benefits have to go to so-called disadvantaged communities, communities of color, and other poor rural white communities that have face the brunt of climate change and are vulnerable to climate change. But while we're working out the details of that, we really believe we need a big picture program that will allow those communities to begin to access funds for things like mass transit, weatherization, low-income solar, et cetera, that they really need. We're not going to just change the economy in New York State by magic. New York State has to invest funding to allow those communities to begin to act.
Now, the legislation that passed, you know, creates this process for establishing some climate plans and recommendations for New York State. It creates a Climate Action Council. Can you give us a quick sense of some of the timelines of those steps?
Sure. So all the law really, first of all, the law technically goes into effect next January 1st, 2020, but nothing stops the state from acting before and doing preparation, and we understand they are doing that. The scoping plan has to be, which is the plan that will lead to regulations, has to be implemented by 2 years after January 1st, 2020, if I remember correctly. So, you know, there's no immediate deadline beyond that. I think there is a deadline for some of the other task forces, but we really believe the state should act as quick as possible. I think it's fair, most of us believe that they will convene the task force in the next few months, but more than just assuming they do it is we want to make sure they do it right and make it a representative of communities and people who are supportive of climate action.
Now, I know moving forward, of course, we need more than $1 billion a year. What you're talking about this year, I believe you have what you call the polluter penalty proposal that would raise, I think, about $7 billion a year if the state was enacted. Can you give us a brief overview of that?
Sure. So what that bill, which is the Climate and Community Investment Act, or as you said, the polluter penalty bill, raises that amount of money by a $35 per ton tax on basically production and extraction of greenhouse gases within the state. And we want to use that money for a number of different things, some of which I outlined before, because the $1 billion and the $7 billion proposal are parallel, but essentially a combination of big ticket items like electrification of buses, money for low-income communities in terms of weatherization, money for transition for workers that are in communities that have power plants and can expect to be shut down due to this, the Climate and Leadership and Community Protection Act, and also rebates that make sure that the public is not adversely impacted by, in the short term at least, there'll be some increased energy bills. We don't think in the long term or in the medium term, but in the short term, there'll be some impact on their energy bills, particularly upstate and in suburban areas.
So we've been talking with Bob Cohen on behalf of New York News, staff person for Citizen Action, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Okay, thanks, Mark, for another awesome educational and informational interview. In our next segment, segment two, in this week's episode of the Triple E's, part two of a conversation with Dr. Paul Miller, a game-changing educator, CEO, and principal of Green Tech High School in Albany, New York. I sat down with Dr. Miller. Here it is. Hello again, everyone. This is H. Bosch Jr. of the Triple E's, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. This is part two of a two-part segment with Dr. Paul Miller. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
All right. Glad to be here. Well, we're just going to dig right in. These questions are going to be about you, and it's going to be rapid fire.
Okay.
Okay? Ready?
Yes, sir.
All right. Three of your favorite book authors and why, being that you're an educator.
Favorite author? Myself. Gotta love yourself first, my
good
brother.
Good question. I like that. Gotta love yourself first. Good answer.
Second, I really love Kuzis and Posner because they are the forefront of leadership. And third, I really appreciate Baruti Kafali. He's a brother who talks about motivating black males.
Okay. All right. Your last book you read?
My last book that I read, it was just one recently, The New Jim Crow Laws.
Ah, Michelle Alexander.
I can't remember the author, but yeah.
Right. I'm in that book now. Great book.
Yeah, it's
great
deep.
Book.
It's deep.
Yep. The New Jim Crow. It is deep, deep. And when I tell you my history with wrongful conviction, wrongful prosecution, you can understand why. Okay, your favorite teacher, what grade and why?
You know what? My favorite teacher probably had to be my third grade teacher, Miss Ronaldo, and I remember her because she was the first teacher I ran into who was built relationships with her kids.
Okay.
And building relationships is the key foundation
Absolutely.
To making sure
that's
you have
how you reach them.
Success with the students.
So is she still around and does she know your success?
You know, I honestly don't know. That's a good question.
Well, now you know something you gotta look into, right?
Maybe I gotta look back into
that's
it.
That's right, right. I mean, and it would be I think it would be a great idea to invite her to your event to let her know what you're doing. How old would you think she would be now?
Oh, I don't know. That's I don't want to. Don't get me in trouble. I don't know.
All right. So outside of your parents, okay, give me two people, mentors, who had a positive impact on your life and why.
Tony Jordan and Trent Jackson. Okay. Tony Jordan, he was a brother. He played in the NFL, and he came home and gave back to the kids in the community and just was one of the more positive influences. Mm-hmm. It was also a Q Omega Sci Phi, which until I die.
You know?
And then my other was Trent Jackson, was my high school football coach. Mm-hmm. And he was also a Q, but you know, Omega's in the house. But he was a brother, just no nonsense. Cuss you out, but love you at the same time.
I hear you. Like you our know? Parents.
Yeah.
All right, they beat the meat off us. Then they turn over and say, you know I love you.
Yeah.
You know that hurt me more than it hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah.
It don't look that
you know,
way.
It was tough love.
Yeah, tough
but
love.
But you knew the
tough.
Brother cared.
Okay. So now let's have some fun. Tell me three of your favorite TV programs growing up and why. Didn't I tell you I was going to hit you with
growing up. Okay, yep. So growing up.
You got to bring it back now.
Thundercats.
Okay.
You know, I was a Thundercat, cartoons, Transformers, and maybe, Different Strokes. Different Strokes. Yeah.
See, Jefferson's. People want to know a little bit about the doctor. The personal side.
I was into the TV.
Okay, so what shows do you like now?
Now, you know what? Because all day and every day is spent and emotionally draining, so I want to zone out and not pay attention. So I love ratchet TV. I love Love and Hip Hop.
Okay.
I love things where I can see other people's drama and I don't have to think about my home.
Well said. Tell me your last movie you saw.
Last movie that I saw, oh goodness, my son and
didn't
I.
Didn't I tell you I was going to hit you, Doc?
You know, my son and I
rapid went, fire here.
Went to the movies to see something. What was it? I can't even remember the last movie that I saw, but it was it The Lion King?
Okay.
I think it was The Lion King we all went right. to go see.
So tell me, and we're going to close out with this, tell me something interesting about you that most people would be surprised to know, Dr. Miller. It's a, wow, that's surprising.
I used to coach women's pro football. And
wow.
When we coached women's pro football, we were...
Alexis, that took us off guard, didn't it? Look at my engineer's face.
We were a game away from the Super Bowl that Stop was played it. In San Diego. Yeah, so we did good.
Say that again. You used to... Yeah.
Coach women's pro football, and I was the offensive coordinator. And, you know, I played a little ball myself, too, and I was a phys ed teacher and a coach. So that's my background with coaching. So I've done that, but I've also coached high school basketball and other things. But the women's pro is always something that, you know, is a little different.
Look, you dropped it like it's hot on that one. My jaw's dropped. Yeah. I'm telling you. That was good. Yeah, I wouldn't have never thought of that. So real quick before I close out, give us some empowering words. If you looked at that young man out there that's in the hood where you came from and saying, why should I pick up a book? You know, why should I try to get out of the hood? Education's not going to help me. What would you say to him, Doctor?
You know what? Your thoughts are things. So the way you think is how you act, and how you act is what you attract.
Come on.
So
come on.
So the Preach. Things that you circle, you put in your circle, and the things you put into yourself and in your head, and the things that you begin to believe are what you're going to get back. So if you start to think different, you'll start to act different. So we got to change your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to change this young man's thoughts and have them see things differently. But they got to believe that there's a way out. So we try to show them a way out.
Great, great, great. So tell me a little bit about family background. You mentioned your son. Okay.
So I have a daughter who's at Morgan State right now, a freshman at Morgan State in Baltimore. My son is...
And for those of you who don't know... What is Morgan State?
HBCU in the house. You know, she's at the HBCU.
Okay.
She's actually coming home this weekend to visit.
Okay.
I got my son who's 13 years old. He's at Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's in seventh grade. And then
athletically inclined
He plays a little basketball. He's actually exceptionally good at track as well. He's a lot faster than I ever will be. I still say I can beat him though.
Uh-huh.
And then I have
my
wife.
That's the mind telling you something that the body can't do.
I know. Uh-huh. I've been hurt myself.
Right.
My wife who actually.
Give a shout out to the wife. Her name?
LaToya Parsons Miller. And she actually. Is a business and entrepreneur. She's a owner of, the Black Expo. So what she is doing...
She's going to be at the Black Expo.
So we're going to...
November 9th.
We're going to work that out.
I'm hosting.
Yes, sir. Because she actually makes holistic skin care and organic health care products.
Uh-huh.
So she makes from the beard butters to oils. You see the beard. So
yeah. I know. I'm looking. Yeah.
You want your beard to grow? I got something for you. But she makes the...
Come on now.
She makes the body butters. She does different... oils for women, like
so
from
November 9th,
oils.
We know where Mrs. Miller is going to be at the Capitol Center, all right?
Yeah.
And the
House
hip
of Holistics.
Hottest, the hip is hottest host in America will be the host right there, yours truly. So, Doc, before I close out, I want to say I thank you, okay? I thank you for what you've done. I thank you for what you're doing. And I thank you for what you continue to do. I see nothing but big, big things in your future.
Thank you, man. I appreciate that greatly. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Oh, man. We so appreciate you. And continued success. And may God continue to bless each and everything you do.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Until next time, it is about the Triple E's. And don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. Hey, I just want to say thanks so much again to Dr. Miller. You are awesome for what you're doing over there at Green Tech. And you are truly, truly a real, real difference maker. And as I said, game-changing educator. We appreciate you. All right, for those of you just tuning in, I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Simone. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. Or if you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at email us at the HMM at mediasanctuary.org or be sure to tune in 7 to 10 p.m. weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. All right, moving right along, rolling in segment 3, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming correspondent Mr. Willie Terry was in Troy Public Library on November 10th at a forum sponsored by the Troy Irish Genealogy Society entitled Troy's Draft Riot of 1863. The speaker was Michael Barrett, executive director of the Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway. In this part one segment, you'll hear his interview with Michael Barrett about the 1863 Troy Draft Riot.
Yeah, this is Willie Terry, a roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm here at the Troy Public Library today, where they just had a speaker who spoke on the draft riots in Troy in 1863, and his name is Michael P. Barron. And he's executive director for the Hudson Mohawk Industrial Gateway. Hi, how you doing, Mike?
I'm well, thank you, and yourself? Nice to see you again.
All right. So, Mike, since we're talking about the draft riot, what is the draft riot of 1863 that happened in Troy?
Well, the super short version is it's the first military draft of American history, and an awful lot of people were deeply upset that it seemed to be very much favoring the aristocratic element of society rather than the working class. It was not a fair selection of names. You could basically pay your way out of it, and so the amount that it took to buy your way out was a year's salary for a working man. And not too many people have got that kind of money saved up and available to give the government.
Well, that kind of sounds familiar in terms of what happened in the 20th century.
Yes. Those who have it, keep it. Those who don't have it, wish they had it, and yep.
Now, what was the, what you say was the key reasons why the draft riot happened?
That's kind of hard to say, key reason. Largely, it really is that resistant mindset, especially amongst the most recent groups of immigrants that were here. The Irish, of course, fleeing the Great Famine of the 1840s. The Germans, who are fleeing massive oppression from the German states. There wasn't a German nation at that time. And a number of the other groups that had begun coming in. I mean, they're fleeing aristocratic oppression. They come here to what they're told is the land of liberty, and they find that the government is basically saying, you're not free. You don't have a choice in this. We're going to make you go fight a war that you've got nothing to do with. And so that really is the driving force for an awful lot of this. And then once the act itself, the Conscription Act, as it was called, of 1863, once it is enacted and publicized and people realize that there's all these loopholes for the moneyed interests to get out of it, you could buy a substitute to go in your place, or you could just pay the money, or... You heard me tell the joke earlier, or get a doctor to say you had bone spurs. yes. Yeah, topical humor. What can I say? But, so, I mean, that really is it. And once they started drawing the names, I mean, it's one thing when it's enacted in February of 1863, but then nothing really happens until July. That's when the names are starting to be drawn. And that's when it comes home to people that this is real. You know, they expect me to go serve in the army for half to a third of what I make as a civilian, and if I'm killed, I mean, they don't care.
Now, you talked a little bit about Irish and immigrants coming from Ireland. Now, so the Irish played an instrumental part in these draft riots?
Yeah, most assured, especially in New York City, although there's a very large Irish contingent in the rioters, known rioters of the Troy riots, and in Boston as well. The Ohio riots, Akron, Toledo, I'm really not sure what the ethnicity of those people were, although I do know there's Germans out there, so that could be, but that's sheer speculation on my part. But in New York City in particular, the Five Points area of New York, which was an Irish Catholic slum, right. And that's the scene of an awful lot of the early rioting right in that area, or crowds that are moving out of that area. And from what we know of the Troy rioters, yes, the Irish Catholics are a very large part of what we had going here. But largely that's because they were the last major wave of immigration. There's Germans here as well, because they're kind of contemporary, the Germans and the Irish coming here. But we had a lot of Irish because there's an awful lot of iron jobs that are unskilled. So, you know, brawn and muscle gets you a job where you don't have to necessarily have education or friends or family ties. There's work to be done here. So.
So when you, in your lecture that you was talking about the draft riot, the riots, what happened is they was kind of targeting certain groups or institutions. And what were those groups and institutions that they were targeting?
Well, it's not that they were necessarily targeting the aristocracy as much as they were targeting any group or person that was considered to be pro-war. Mm-hmm. So if you're running a little mom and pop grocery store, but you're known to be pro-war, you may very well have been looted when the crowd passed your store. If you were anti-war, you were probably pretty safe. As I mentioned with the two newspapers, side by side, right. The one that's pro-war is sacked, and the anti-war newspaper right next door is completely unmolested. Mm-hmm. So they were going after a lot of the prominent citizens, but the prominent citizens also tended to be pro-war. So it wasn't necessarily that they're chasing after the one percenters because they have money. It's the fact that they're chasing after them because they're pro-war. Mm-hmm. So, and then once the evening comes and darkness falls, then I think it just became wholesale criminal activity. I mean, nobody was paying attention to the political leanings of the guy who owns a warehouse on River Street. They're just breaking in and stealing. And, oh, well, somebody's going to set fire to it? No, so much. Right. But during the actual political day, the riot, the people who suffered the most, excepting the blacks, who were terrorized and forced out of the city, they're the pro-war people. Mm-hmm. And the blacks, of course, it's because we all know that they started this.
Yeah. So that was the kind of sense.
There's, well, yes.
That the blacks had started. Because I, you know, amazed what you're saying, that how they burned, lynched and beat up, you know, black people during this time. And these wasn't the slaves. I mean, most of here was it a free blacks?
In New York City, most of the blacks that are known to have been murdered during the riots were actually free people. Had never been or had been freed when New York State abolished slavery in 1827. But they were free people. You know, these are not because, there were no slave coachmen getting dragged off coaches. These are people who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And Lincoln has made the war now about slavery and the abolition of slavery. So the blacks are going to be scapegoated.
And what about the question of jobs? Because you mentioned something about blacks coming up, taking their
jobs. There's an awful lot of that. I mentioned that in the lecture, that the Irish Catholics and the blacks during this whole period, the 1850s, 60s, 70s, they're fighting for the low-level jobs in the economic scheme of things, because the Irish are considered to be the lowest rung of European society. So now they're over here, they're the lowest rung, and of course they need somebody below them, and that's going to be the blacks. And the people who have the ability to offer jobs recognize that if they can get a black man to work for 80% of what they have to pay an Irish Catholic, well, you know, they're going to do that. And that's going to make the Irish Catholics quite angry. So they play them off of each other. If you read your economic history of that period, I mean, there was an awful lot of very deliberate driving of the antagonism between those two groups because it's good for the aristocracy. You know, if they're fighting each other, if they're hurting each other, then they're not coming after us. And if we can actually use their ability to desperately need money to lower the pay scale that I've got to offer, that's really gravy for this. And that's an awful lot of what it was. And that really continued, I mean, around here, especially in the railroad industry, right into the 1930s. My great-grandfather worked for the Delaware and Hudson River, or the railroad, excuse me. And I mean, he was notoriously anti-black because he was fighting every day to keep his job because somebody was going to underbid him.
Okay, thank you once again, Mr. Terry, for an excellent educational and informative interview. We appreciate you. All right. Now, segment number four, our opening lead, Christian Copper, a recent SUNY grad student, speaks with Michelle Mashurian, Upstate Housing host, about Christian's documentary film, I'm Warrior Women and Housing Injustice, which was filmed in the Capital Region. The film will be shown Monday, November 18th, 7 p.m. at 255 Orange Street in Albany, New York.
Good day, all, and welcome to the Upstate Housing Program. My name is Michelle Mashurian, and I will be your host, bringing you news and information regarding the struggle for decent, affordable housing in the Capital Region. Just a reminder, with cold weather moving in, heat must be supplied from October 1st through May 31st. If the temperature falls below 55 degrees between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m., each apartment must be heated to a temperature of at least 68 degrees. The City of Albany also requires, if the outside temperature falls below zero, each apartment must be heated to a temperature of at least 68 degrees. Affordable housing advocates believe homelessness became official policy of the federal government when President Richard Nixon put a moratorium on the construction of public housing, and then President Ronald Reagan enacted drastic cuts to rental assistance programs. With housing costs rising since the financial crisis of 2008, the housing problem has only gotten worse. My guest today is Christian Copper, a SUNY grad student, to discuss her documentary film called I Am Warrior, Women and Housing Injustice. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you.
Christian, can you let us share with us and our listeners what your documentary film is about?
Sure. So it's focused on housing injustice in the Capital Region, specifically Albany, but there's also some interviews from people in Schenectady and Rensselaer. It just covers a wide range of housing topics like homelessness, poor housing conditions, retaliatory evictions, and the stigma that follows Section 8.
So what's the stigma that follows Section 8 that you found out about?
A lot of landlords don't like to accept it, or people tend to think that people on Section 8 might be lazy or they don't want to work, which is totally inaccurate.
So what made you want to produce this film?
So at the time I was in graduate school, I was studying women, gender, and sexuality studies. So I knew I wanted to do a documentary film, and I was looking for a subject that would be interesting and a good focus for women. I had done a lot of research on like reproductive rights and women's bodies, that type of thing. And my best friend actually works for United Tenants of Albany, and I was having a conversation with her, and she mentioned, you know, a lot of my clients that come in are actually women. Women are often found at the center of housing injustice issues. And I thought, wow, you know, why aren't we talking about housing issues in my classes or more in our communities? So I immediately jumped on that, and I thought it would be good to make a film about that to help, you know, just bring the community together to talk about it and also help bring my classmates and professors in on it to talk about it in classrooms, too.
Did you show the film to your classmates and professor?
Yeah, yep. I had a screening at the end of the semester on the campus. So there was a lot of students there and some other people from the community, and people who were featured in the film got to come and see it. And after the film, there was a discussion and people kind of shared some of their ideas and views on housing issues and maybe how to fix things. So it was really awesome to see. So I'm kind of hoping the same thing can happen with this screening.
So it becomes like an educational tool?
Yes, definitely. That's what I'm hoping it can be, is an educational tool. And I was looking for this film to kind of just give a space for women to be able to share their experiences and tell their stories, because I think when people are able to share their personal experiences, it's really powerful.
So in making of the film, were there things that surprised you that came out of the film that you weren't anticipating?
I think I was just surprised by how like resilient people are who deal with these housing issues, and how fearless they are fighting against these issues. You know, a lot of people will go to court and just basically represent themselves to get through, you know, these issues and try to have a good solution. And they might, I mean, having a home that you feel safe in is so important for like your mental health and your physical health. So not having that is such a stress. So to know that some people have this stress, that they don't have a secure home and they're still able to wake up every morning and go to work, take care of their families and continue to fight for like better housing is really amazing to me.
Do you have any particular story that stood out that you would like to share?
There's a couple stories in the documentary film, so if people come, they can definitely come see those in more detail. But yeah, there's a couple women featured in the film that share their stories of, you know, I think it's mainly, there's one about retaliatory eviction and then one about poor housing conditions and how they go to court to represent like what they're going through and try to get a conclusion to it.
So what got you interested in housing, and specifically housing in the capital region, where we have over 45% of renters paying more than 35% of their gross income from rent?
Yes, I think I was interested in the housing issues. I chose specifically here just because this is where I lived. But as I was doing research, I realized what we're experiencing here in the capital region is happening all over the United States, you know. People are getting paid low wages and expected to pay these really high rent costs. And exactly like you said, I found a lot of people are using majority of their paychecks to pay for their rent. So they don't have much left for, you know, utility bills, for food, gas, that type of thing. So it's a struggle. I think I was just interested too, because it seems like a topic that needs to be talked about more. We hear a lot about education and healthcare, and I'm wondering why there's not more conversation on housing when that's such an important aspect of people's lives.
Have you been following any of the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates and their outlook on housing and housing reform?
I've watched some of the debates, and that's, I think, again, where I'm like, it seems like it's not, you know, a hot topic that's talked about too much. And again, I wish it was talked about more in those debates.
So housing issues can be very complicated, with a lot of good and bad actors on both sides, the landlord and tenant side, plus zoning and building law rules to adhere to. What, you know, based on what you've learned, would you propose to fix the homeless problem, or what housing policies would you change?
what I would hear a lot from the people I interviewed, because I would also interview people who work in the field, it sounds like they just are asking for more funding on certain things. So, you know, with more money from the state, better shelters, better programs can be funded, conditions can get better in those shelters and places like that. So that seemed to be a main thing, was like asking for funding and making sure we're getting that.
Was a majority of the women in, were they homeless or were they just living in substandard housing or a combination?
My film features both. So I interview some women who are dealing with their like apartments that they're renting having issues, and there's also women featured that are dealing with homelessness issues. A major part of the storyline is this 24-hour vigil that took place at the state capitol, where they came to protest and basically demand, you know, more funding and being able to have better resources.
So what exactly was this protest?
So they called it the 24-hour vigil for the 89,000 homeless New Yorkers. And it was also asking for the Home Stability Support Act to be passed, which I know unfortunately did not happen. But they rallied for a full 24 hours, so that's in my film as well.
Wow. So what conclusions have you drawn from making this film?
I would say that housing needs to be viewed as a basic human right, I think. And to start, a lot of people, it's kind of like a business model, so sometimes landlords can benefit from it or benefit from even like evictions and things like that. And I would like, you know, housing to be viewed as, I also feel like, healthcare. It shouldn't be something that people are profiting from. It's a basic human right, so people deserve that.
So less of a commodity and, mm-hmm. and more of, you know, sustaining human, taking care of human beings.
Yeah.
In wrapping up, is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners?
I guess just like I said before, that the film, I hope it can be a tool for education and sparking some, you know, communication in our neighborhoods. So I hope people can show up to the screening and also feel free to share, you know, their thoughts or views or things after the screening as well. So the screening will be Monday, November 18th at 7 p.m. at United Tenants of Albany, which is 255 Orange Street in Albany.
Okay, and that's Monday, November 18th at 7 p.m. It is free and open to the public. And I thank you, Kristen, for joining us today on the Upstate Housing Program.
Thank you.
That was Kristen Koper discussing her new documentary, I Am Warrior, Women in Housing and Justice. The documentary film will also be available on YouTube after November 18th. Next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Elizabeth Press interviewed Rensselaer County's District Attorney Mary Pat Donnelly on bail reform.
Next up, I'm joined by Mary Pat Donnelly. She is the Rensselaer County District Attorney. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me.
In New York, criminal justice reform laws are poised to take effect in the coming months. The new laws limit bail, expand pretrial discovery, and encourage speedy trials. One area of reform is pretrial detention, which will be curtailed, though generally not when it comes to those facing felony charges. Some district attorneys, including you, say that the reform as drafted isn't practical, and you've criticized lawmakers for playing roulette with public safety. Can you explain this and what other DAs and lawmakers who support this are missing?
First of all, I think almost exclusively all of the elected district attorneys are not in favor of the reforms as drafted. I, along with most, and I think it's fair to say that, are in favor of reform. We do agree that there needed to be changes made. I was a big supporter of that, and I still am. Open discovery, I don't have a problem with open discovery. I think that the right thing to do is to turn over as much as you can, as soon as you can. We don't want people making decisions on their plea deals without the knowledge of what we've got against them. Unfortunately, the discovery reforms that were put in place have put us in a position that's gonna be very hard to accomplish. 15 days is an extremely quick turnaround when you're talking about the fact that you're dealing with Rensselaer County, where we're sitting here in the city of Troy, where Troy City Court meets most days. Detroit police work 24/7. You're talking about people being arraigned out in some of the rural towns, and those courts meet every 14 days. So by the time the DA's office is even aware that something has transpired in a local court, sometimes a good portion of our time has already elapsed. Now, these certain deadlines as guidelines, I don't have a problem with. I'm very concerned about our ability to meet the deadlines that have been put forth in these discovery forms, and that's why I have a problem with it. With reference to bail, I mentioned my prior job was a town judge. I fully support presumptive release on misdemeanors. I think in most cases, bail does not need to be set. But I can tell you that taking the discretion away from the judge who is face-to-face with that defendant concerns me greatly. The judge knows their community. They get to know the folks that are in front of them. You get to know when someone's in a bad way and you're concerned that they're going to reoffend, hurt someone in a way that can't be fixed. You get to know someone's criminal history. You know who's coming back to court and who's not. And I think that's what bothers me, is that you can't lose sight of that is the purpose of bail. We're not holding people because we don't want them in the community. We're holding them so that, or we're setting bail, or in some cases remanding, to make sure they're available for trial. I really feel that taking all of the discretion away from the judges is what's very, very dangerous to me. There's a lot I could say about it, but I just based on my experience, I've had people stand in front of me and laugh and say, I'm not coming back. And now I have to say, okay, I'll text you. Hopefully you will. And in some of those cases, at the end of the day, is it really going to matter if they're stealing, you know, a carton of milk from Walmart? You know, things like that aren't going to be a problem. But we're talking about cases where we have folks with substance abuse disorders, folks whose families are trying desperately to get them in a place, and I can no longer use any type of pretrial detention as a tool in the toolbox. Drug dealers, that's another big problem for me. Major weight is no longer going to be eligible. We know that there are street-level drug dealers, there are folks with substance abuse disorders, there are people all along the chain, people who are there for a variety of different reasons, because of their background, because of their desperation, because of an addiction, whatever it might be, no longer will police be able to build those cases against the high-level traffickers. It's going to be very, very difficult to do that. And that's concerning to me as well. So there are a lot of components of the bail reform that I have a big problem with. I'm not a legislator, and I don't intend to go that direction. My suggestion, my preference would have been something like presumptive release with a requirement that a judge articulate their decision to waiver from that, and then a quick review, perhaps a 48-hour review by a higher judge. No one should be sitting in jail pretrial just because they can't afford bail, and I absolutely support that. And I think we've missed the mark on this. I think we tried to do the right thing, and it's going to be very, very hard to implement. And I think we're going to see in January, I know my office at least, the word triage is being used way, way too often across the state. Low-level drug charges are going to become very, very hard to prosecute under the discovery statute. And for some, that's not a problem. But for some, it really is. I mean, some people, the criminal justice system should be a deterrent. You should not want to become part of it. And as it loses its ability to be punitive, people are going to lose respect for it. And I do have a concern that there's going to be a trickle-down problem because of that.
In preparing for this, I read that approximately 25,000 people are in local jails across New York, and about 16,000 of those people are in jail because they can't afford the bail. That's a big portion of people who are being held because they can't actually meet bail. So my question is, does it become, as things stand now, that bail is a class issue?
Well, I think many people argue that, and there are statistics that would support that. If a judge is doing their job, that shouldn't be the case, because bail should be set in most cases as an amount that the person doesn't want to lose but can afford. I am supposed to evaluate an unemployed individual differently than a young kid from the suburbs whose parents are standing right behind him. If I'm setting the same bail on both of those people, then I'm not doing my job, because the kid with the parents standing right behind him is going to have the ability to pay that bail, and it's probably not going to be an incentive for him to come back to court. The person who has no home or is living with relatives, is unemployed, down on their luck, obviously bail should be much lower for them because they're not going to be able to meet the same amount and they're not going to be incited to come back for the same amount. So, and again, that it, we leave a lot in the gray area, and that's the problem with the system. What I feel like the changes have done is they've said, well, it wasn't working this way, so we're just going to trash that and go this way. And I feel like there's somewhere in the middle where we could use a little more human discretion to make sure we're doing the right thing.
And there's another thing I was hoping that you could help clarify. I read that Republican Governor Chris Christie passed essentially the same bail reform laws years ago in New Jersey, and the state reports that they have shown an overall crime that has decreased and that no statistically significant changes regarding reoffenses in court. And I think similarly, New York City pretrial incarceration is already mainly limited to populations who would still be in jail under the new law, and crime has gone down there. So if these two things or either of these things you agree with are occurring, and why do you think it would be different here upstate?
Oh, I can tell you why it's different upstate. We do not have the pretrial services that are available in New York City, which brings us to the point that these mandates were handed down with absolutely no funding. New York City is a much, much different environment. There is a lot more, there's a lot more pretrial service out there to ensure that people are going to go back to work. We have very few. Additionally, with reference to New Jersey, my understanding is that their judges are still able to use a risk assessment tool. They're able to look at someone's criminal history and make a determination as to whether or not they're going to come back. And we're not allowed to do that now or under the new law.
Mary Pat Donnelly, we are quickly running out of time, but I want to make sure that you get in the last word. Is there anything else you want to say on this or anything else that we haven't touched on?
Just it's a pleasure to serve the residents of Rensselaer County. It is an extremely challenging job. I am a person who likes to make people feel comfortable with what I am doing, and that's a difficult thing to do in this situation because decisions have to be made and on these very, very important topics that are somewhat polarizing. I just want the community to know that every decision I make is with what I believe to be the best interests of the community. And, you know, I welcome an opportunity to defend any decisions that I make that people don't agree with because I want people to know that I'm working for them. And no matter what I do, I'm going to continue to do what I think is right and hopefully move Rensselaer County forward.
Thank you. I mean, I imagine it must be hard juggling the pressures of those that are in power on both the Republican and Democratic side versus the desires, demands of the people and especially the progressive community.
It's a very difficult balance to make things work. And I really think the answer is just dealing with people on a personal level and getting to know people so that everybody at least feels confident. I mean, I've seen this before where you don't always agree with your elected representative, but if you know they're working for you and they're telling you the truth, which I think is the most important thing, I think it's something that gives people a certain level of comfort. So I hope, if anything else, people will know that I am being honest with them and I've taken on a very difficult job at a very difficult time. It's about to get a lot more difficult in 2020. Whether you're in favor of the reforms or not, the lack of funding is a real problem for the district attorney's office.
Mary Pat Donnelly, thank you for joining us on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth E.P. Press, for a great, great interview on a topic that's very, very near and dear to me, as you very well know. Please continue to keep up the good work, and you are a true agent of change. In closing, that was the Rensselaer County District Attorney, Mary Pat Donnelly, talking about bail reform in New York State. If you missed part one of the interview with Mary Pat Donnelly, please visit our website, mediasanctuary.org, or click here, mediasanctuary.org. Mary Pat Donnelly, Rensselaer County District Attorney, part one. Okay.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Simone.
And I'm your host, H. Brosh Jr., with our engineer tonight, Erica. Thank you so much, Erica, for an outstanding job. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page if you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in every 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. weeknights for the Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Thank you.